was born by the river. In a little tent. But oh, just like the river's been running, I've been running ever since. It's been a long, a long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. Oh, yes it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. My mama never told me what goes on beyond the sky. It's been a long, a long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was A Change Is Gonna Come. The original version is by Sam Cooke, and that was a cover by a band that I just discovered a few weeks ago and have not been able to stop listening to, and that's Baby Huey and the Babysitters. The album is The Baby Huey Story, The Living Legend. And it's really an incredible, incredible album, an incredible band. And unfortunately, Baby Huey died a couple of months before this album even came out. And this album came out, you know, way back, like late 60s, early 70s. And Baby Huey died, the album came out, and it kind of disappeared after a while, and only to be rediscovered recently. And it's really well worth listening to. You can get your hands on it, pick it up, listen to it. You'll probably be listening to it 1,000 times a week, just like I am. Anyway, the cover of A Change Is Going to Come is extremely powerful and apropos for what we're going to be talking about in the show this week.
From time to time, I replay past interviews, sometimes because I think we need to be reminded of important perspectives, and sometimes because past interviews can take on a new relevance in the moment we're currently in. And given what's going on in America at present, with the Trump-Pence regime, a fascist regime that is moving really fast to put in place a fully fascist system, I want to replay something that focused on a key aspect of this, the oppression of black people.
I thought it would be really important to, you know, do something along those lines that I thought would really drive home the idea that we are certainly, no matter how much they tell us this, we are certainly not living in a time that is beyond racism, that is beyond color, that is beyond the savage oppression of black people. And when I was looking back at what I had to play and what I thought would be important to bring out to people, I found this conversation I had in the late 2008 with Douglas Blackman, the author of Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II, an incredibly powerful book. So I wanted to play that for you. So again, we'll be listening to a rebroadcast of an interview I did with Douglas Blackman back in late 2008. And then at the back end of the show, we'll be listening to an excerpt of a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which basically gets into the fact that the savage oppression of black people did not stop after the Civil War. It didn't stop in the early 20th century. It didn't stop in the mid-20th century. In fact, it's just as savage and even more terrible today. So without any further ado, let's take a listen to my conversation with Douglas Blackman.
A little while ago, I came across a book that I just have, I picked it up and I was fascinated by the title. I read a little something on it and decided I really had to get this book. And it is one of the most compelling histories I've ever read. It's a history that really cracks something open for those of us who think we know
a lot about what's happened, what's going on, especially around that era, Reconstruction in the South. People who are questioning where the oppression of black people in this country come from today, what's its roots. This book, Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II by Douglas Blackman, is a must read. It's an incredibly powerful book and something that really cracks open a whole new knowledge scheme, something that will really help you understand what's going on here. Douglas Blackman, who's written the book, and he's also the Atlanta Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, and he's written extensively about race in American society. He's here to join us today. Douglas, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, and sure. Thank you for your kind words about the book.
Every one of them are heartfelt. I sat up and I at points couldn't put it down, and you'll go into things with a certain precept, with a certain set of things that you think you know what happened, and then something like this comes and it just twists it. And I wanted to start off with this. At the end of your book, you talk about that you feel that that period of time between the end of the betrayal of Reconstruction, the overthrow of Reconstruction, the destruction of Reconstruction, and the World War II, or even maybe even beyond into the early 50s, you talk about that, how you feel that that should not be called the Jim Crow era, but rather that it should be called the age of neo-slavery. Can you explain that?
I mean, there are two points that I'm really making there. One is, in some respects, the biggest demonstration that I hope the book makes, and that is that this period of time, beginning at the end of the 19th century and continuing up into World War II, as a country, we have shared in a national instinct to have a sort of collective amnesia, or at a minimum, a minimization of the reality of the things that really happened to African Americans all across the South in that period of time. And one aspect of that minimizing the offenses of this period has been to call it the Jim Crow era. Now, I don't think that's what people intended when it began to be known as that, but in hindsight, that's fairly clear to me. Jim Crow was a character that was played in the beginning by a particular actor who would perform in blackface and do comedy routines that were meant to denigrate black Americans. Before the Civil War, that became an incredibly popular form of entertainment. After the Civil War, and Jim Crow came to define the entertainment of that era and the symbolism of blacks in the South, I liken that to our calling the 1930s in Germany, if we named that period of time after the most popular anti-Semitic comedian of Germany at that time. I think we would all recognize that that was an offensive way to refer to that period in history. In reality, what Slavery by Another Name demonstrates, I think, is that in truth, at the beginning of the 20th century, a new form of forced labor involving hundreds of thousands of people and terrorizing hundreds of thousands of other people had emerged in the South that amounted to what I call neo-slavery, and we should call it what it was, the age of neo-slavery.
I have studied that period to a certain degree, and you know, I had some sense of what happened after the Civil War, that after the Confederacy was defeated, and there was a certain flowering of, you depict a sense of freedom when you speak about it in your book. And then but what you're talking about, this age of neo-slavery, is there actually, you're talking about a whole new stage of slavery that came after Reconstruction, right?
Yes. After the Civil War, African Americans in huge numbers all across the South experienced an authentic period of emancipation. Now, it wasn't, you know, it was never as it really should have been, and it was a tough time, and a world of poverty and deprivation of services and great difficulty and great animosity between blacks and whites at the time. So it wasn't a perfect time, but it was an era in which millions and millions, and there were 4 million blacks essentially at the end of the Civil War in the South, and huge numbers of those people participated in elections. They were accorded the full rights of being citizens as guaranteed by the 15th Amendment. They had jobs, they had farms, they had employment of various kinds. Like I said, it was a difficult, poverty-stricken time, but there was true emancipation and true freedom. But what began to happen in the South, particularly after federal troops were removed in 1877, and even more so after another 15 years when it became clear that there was no possibility that white Northerners would ever send federal troops back to enforce civil rights, all across the South, the state legislatures of every state passed laws which began to effectively criminalize black life and to create a situation in which African American men found it almost impossible not to be in violation of some misdemeanor statute at almost all times. And the most broadly applied of those was that it was against the law to be, if you were unable to prove at any given moment that you were employed. And so vagrancy statutes were used to arrest thousands of black men, and even though thousands of white men could have been arrested on the same charges, but they hardly ever were. And then once arrested, the judicial system had been retooled in such a way as to coerce huge numbers of men into commercial enterprises as forced workers through the judicial system, and then thousands of other people lived in fear of having that happen to them, and that was part of how they were intimidated into going along with other kinds of coercive labor, like sharecropping and farm tenancy and many other things.
Give people a sense of the scope of this. In your book, you concentrate a lot on Alabama, which I really enjoy the device you used. I really thought that was very powerful, the device you used to sort of woven through it is this one character that you're searching for, really what happened to him and where was he from, his life before that, his ancestors, and what's happened since. But you unfold something that it concentrates a lot in Alabama, but the scope of this was huge, right? Both in terms of the numbers of people involved, as well as the spread across the South.
This was a phenomenon that by the beginning of the 20th century, in effect, as of 1901, every southern state had completely disenfranchised virtually all African Americans. There was no black voting of any meaningful degree still occurring in the South as of 1901. And every southern state had this some version of this array of laws that could be used to arrest almost any black man who did not live under the explicit control and protection of a white man. And every southern state, in one manner or another, had adopted the practice of, rather than imprisoning the people who were convicted of these flimsy or fictitious crimes, of actually leasing them out to commercial enterprises for periods of one or two or sometimes much longer periods of time as forced workers. And Alabama was the place where the system lasted the longest in its most explicit form and was the most evolved in terms of how every county government and the enormity of the numbers of African-American men who were leased by the state. And in the case of Alabama, there were at least 100,000 African-American men between the 1890s and the 1930s, or about 1930, at least 100,000 African-American men were leased or sold by the state of Alabama to coal mines, iron ore mines, sawmills, timber harvesting camps, cotton plantations, turpentine stills all across the state. There were at least another 100,000, and I suspect many more. The records are incomplete, but at least another 100,000 just in Alabama were similarly leased out of the local courts, just where a county judge, in cooperation with a local sheriff, would parcel out all of the prisoners that were rounded up and brought to the county jail. And so at least 200,000, probably more like 250,000 to 300,000 African Americans just in Alabama were forced into the system just in the most informal ways. And there are very well-documented records of thousands of black men who died under these circumstances during that period of time. And I document in the book the stories of men like Jonathan Davis, who in the fall of 1901 left his cotton field to try to reach the home of his wife's parents, where she was being cared for and would soon die of an illness. And he was trying to reach her before she died. And on his way to the town 15 or 20 miles away where she was being taken care of, he's accosted on the road by a constable and essentially is kidnapped from the roadway and sold to a white farmer a few days later for $45. And that is something which happened in the book. I name dozens of people that happened to. It's clear that some version of that sort of kidnapping happened to hundreds and hundreds of other African Americans. And again, all of that is just in Alabama. And there were versions of this going on in all of the southern states. And so in reality, there's no doubt in my mind that hundreds of thousands of African Americans had these events occur to them, and millions of African Americans lived in a form of terror of this happening either to them or to their families.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. I'm talking now with Douglas Blackman, the author of a very important book, Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. And if you haven't come across it and you care at all about truth in history and what impact that has on today and the future, you need to get your hands on this book from Doubleday Press. This is a rebroadcast of a conversation we had when the book first came out back in 2008. Now, Douglas, when we talk about reenslavement, I think there might be a sort of a subjective reaction to people saying, well, reenslavement, was it really as bad as slavery? Give people a sense of the conditions that you've actually documented because they were horrifying.
Well, Green Cottenham, for instance, the character you referred to a moment ago, who much of the book is woven around the life of Green Cottenham and the family of slaves and former slaves that he descended from and what happened in the course of slavery's resurrection and how it began to intrude upon the lives of those former slaves and their descendants, and finally how Green Cottonham is, as he rises into adulthood at the beginning of the 20th century, he is arrested in Columbiana, Alabama, outside the train depot in a completely spurious situation where initially it's claimed that he broke one minor law, and then later it's claimed that he broke a different minor law, and finally when he's brought before the county judge 3 days later, the judge simply, to settle the confusion, declares him guilty of yet another offense of vagrancy. And on the basis of that, he's fined $10, I think, was the actual fine, and then on top of that, he's charged a whole series of fees associated with his arrest, a fee to the sheriff, a fee to the deputy who actually arrested him, some of the costs of his being jailed for 3 days, fees for the witnesses who testified against him, even though there, as far as I can tell, there were no witnesses. All of these things added up to effectively about a year's wages for an African-American farm laborer at the time, and an amount that obviously someone like Green Cottonham, an impoverished, largely illiterate African-American man in 1908, could not have paid. And so in order to pay those fines off as part of the system, he is leased to U.S. Steel Corporation, a company that still exists today, and forced to go to work in a coal mine on the outskirts of Alabama with about 1,000 other black forced laborers. And those men lived under almost unspeakable conditions in terms of that they worked much of the time deep in the mines in standing water, which was the seepage which would come out from under the earth. They were forced to stay in that water and consume that water for lack of any other fresh water, even though it was putrid and polluted by their own waste. They had to operate in these unbelievably cramped circumstances. If they failed, any man who failed to extract at least 8 tons of coal from the mine every day would be whipped at the end of the day. And if he repeatedly failed to get his quota of coal out, he would be whipped at the beginning of the day as well. The men entered the mine before daylight. They exited the mine after sunset. They lived in an endless period of darkness under these horrifying circumstances. They had little medical care. They were subject to waves of dysentery and tuberculosis and other illnesses, and it was ultimately one of those epidemics of disease which caused Green Cottonham to die 5 months after he arrived at the jail in August of 1908. And those conditions, and far worse ones even, were incredibly common in the forced labor camps that by then had emerged all across the Deep South.
One of the terrible ironies you bring up in your book is that in the previous form of slavery, that actually a slave master, a slave owner, was a little bit more hesitant to outright just kill a slave because it was a lot more invested in the slave. But in this neo-slavery, that was one of the ways they exercised their terroristic dominance over the mass of forced laborers, was actually a slave's life was inconsequential.
Yes, that's right. Before the Civil War, in the antebellum slavery that we all know more about, or at least think we know more about, under that system, as terrible as it was, and nothing that I say is to minimize how terrible antebellum slavery was, but the economic incentives of that system explicitly encouraged the preservation of slaves, because a slave owner had invested large sums of money in the acquisition of a slave, and then they wanted the slave to live as long as possible, both so that they would have the productivity of them as a worker, but also so that they would procreate and there would be more slaves, which would add to the value of the assets of the farm. This was the fundamental economic formula of antebellum slavery. There was also a sense in the religious beliefs that were prevalent at the time that God had ordained slavery, but that white men had some obligation nonetheless to care for this lower species. And this was something that whites were routinely taught every Sunday morning. Well, in the new slavery that emerged after the Civil War, it actually had its beginnings in an experiment with industrial slavery that had begun in the Deep South just before the Civil War, when a handful of industrialists had begun to experiment with using black slaves in settings like iron foundries and sawmills and coal mines and other of these coarse industrial activities. That was extremely profitable for those slave owners before the Civil War. And one of the reasons they began to realize, one of the reasons why it was so profitable, was that when you removed black men from family settings and took the view that as long as the enterprise has received a return on its investment within 4 or 5 years by working these men at a pace far beyond what any human being could be expected to survive, that you could begin to make a profit off of these men in a relatively short period of time, and if they then died or were worked to death, that that was a reasonable bargain in the economic equation of industrial slavery. Well, that process was stopped by the Civil War. But after the war, some of the very same men were the leaders of the effort to begin reengineering this new kind of neo-slavery after the Civil War. And as it metastasized across the South at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century, this much more brutal, more harsh form of slavery was endemic. And there were few women in the picture. It was overwhelmingly focused on young black men, and they were routinely worked to death or put into positions where their death was likely or probable. And because it cost so little to acquire them through the judicial system and through the fake judicial systems that emerged to feed this traffic in humans, there was little incentive to protect these workers in any way, and they rarely were.
We're talking with Douglas Blackman, the author of Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. When you're talking about the Civil War, and the Civil War actually was a war between the slave system and capitalism. And there was actually a moral component of it in terms of people actually taking a stand that slavery was wrong and it shouldn't exist. But then what happened was there was this whole, along with a lot of other things in the superstructure, there was a reassessment of the Civil War that actually went along with the kind of the birth of this neo-slavery and the implementation of this neo-slavery. And at the same time, when slavery was defeated in, as the dominant economic system in the South, you had this need to industrialize the South to fully bring capitalism into the South. And also you had the growth of the need to expand of capitalism generally in the country. A lot of this tied into, when you mentioned U.S. Steel, it made me think of this, a lot of this tied into the existence of this neo-slavery in the South.
That's right, on several fronts there. I mean, one of the interesting things to me as I tried to plumb these phenomenons in the course of the 7 years of research that I did on this while doing a few other things too, but I spent a lot of time trying to understand why it was that in the aftermath of slavery, of the Civil War, and especially after a period of time in which there actually had been a fair amount of successful black and white interaction politically in the South, as in fact there was in many places for a period of time after the Civil War, but why was it that in spite of all of that, and in spite of the fairly obvious moral rectitude of having ended slavery once it had finally come about, why was it that there was so much venom and animosity among white Southerners and such an insistence to begin returning to some kind of forced labor? And one of the things that became clear to me as I studied what was happening on cotton farms and in other settings across the South was that, number one, the Southern economy and in some respects the national economy were addicted to forced labor. White Southerners really had no idea how to grow cotton without the availability of armies of forced black workers to do that work, both in terms of the need for manual laborers and the intellectual knowledge that was necessary to deploy those laborers in the setting of cotton farms and some of these other, even in industrial settings. This addiction to forced labor was so great that there was this enormous compulsion to return to it. But in the end, it's perhaps not all that surprising that white Southerners conducted themselves in the way that they did in terms of their ability to mete out such violence and depravity, really, against African Americans. Maybe that's not such a surprise. But what was shocking to me, as I began to understand it better, was the degree to which that whites outside the South, whites all over the country, began to reassess the Civil War, began to reassess the mythology of the Civil War that had viewed it as a war of liberation and emancipation, and began to instead be driven by a sense that the integration of slaves and their children and grandchildren into mainstream American society was simply too hard and was not worth the effort. Even Ulysses Grant, the great Union general, during his presidency in the 1880s, confided to a member of his cabinet that he had come to realize that the 15th Amendment, which gave full citizenship to freed slaves, had been a mistake. And by the end of the 19th century, when President McKinley is assassinated in 1901, and McKinley is the last Union officer to hold the presidency, and the generation who had made up the Union Army and that army of liberation had become a geriatric generation who were passing from the national stage. When Teddy Roosevelt becomes president as a result of that assassination in 1901, he enters the White House as an idealist, very committed to rights for blacks. But by the end of his presidency, he, along with the vast majority of white Americans in every region of the country, have turned completely against the idea that blacks should be guaranteed a full place at the table of American life and American citizenship. And for me, that was one of the most remarkable aspects of coming to understand the sequence of events, was this great betrayal of Southern blacks by their former allies outside of the South.
The other part of that question was actually this thing about the expansion and the accumulation of capital and the profitability of this neo-slavery for the growth of this system.
Well, particularly at the end of the 19th century, when you had this explosion in parts of the South, like Alabama, northern Georgia, and the areas, the sort of coastal areas of the South, where there were these huge forests of pine trees, mostly virgin timber, millions of acres of virgin pine forest, where there was an enormous industry of harvesting pine rosin from the trees that was then distilled into turpentine. And that was really, in some respects, that was as important a commodity to the U.S. economy in 1900 as gasoline is today. That's a slight exaggeration, but not much of one. It was an incredibly lucrative business that involved thousands and thousands and thousands of people and millions of dollars. And all of those enterprises, particularly in the South, were incredibly reliant, as was railroad building, another one of the main ones. All of those enterprises and industries were overwhelmingly dependent on the use of forced labor and also the existence of forced labor systems to depress the wages of free laborers. And those were incredibly important phenomenons of the economic revitalization and industrialization of the South. And many of the fortunes that were accumulated at that point in time, particularly in cities like Atlanta, where I live, some of the most prominent families and most prominent corporations, publicly traded corporations that exist today, their roots are either explicitly connected to this kind of forced labor, or the wealth that was used to build those companies, such as Coca-Cola Company and many others, the wealth that flowed to create those corporations stemmed originally from these forced labor practices.
Now, one question I have is that you've talked about the use of the courts in enslaving people, but there's also this question of, we had the amendments, and you speak to this in the book, and I thought it'd be good to just talk about this a little bit. You've had the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. You had what people assume would be various federal legal remedies to this. What was actually the story in terms of being able to go to the courts to stop this kind of stuff?
The real story was that while slavery was unconstitutional on the basis of the 13th Amendment, and clearly it was explicitly the case that no state could pass laws to recreate a formal system of slavery, no person could hold a deed showing that they owned a person as a slave and file that deed at the courthouse. That clearly could not happen. That was unconstitutional. But the Congress had never taken the next step, the next logical step, of passing a criminal statute which made it explicitly a crime to enslave another person. There were laws on the books that could have been used to prosecute someone for holding a slave, such as kidnapping and similar laws, but at that time, those were all state offenses and could only have been prosecuted by state officials like a county sheriff or the attorney general of a southern state. But the reality was no southern state would ever bring such a case or such charges against a white man in the South, and no white jury in the South under almost any circumstances would convict a white man for that. And so it created this kind of legal limbo in which slavery was unconstitutional, but there was no federal statute which actually made it a crime to hold slaves. And so as the years went by and thousands of complaints poured into the White House and into the Department of Justice in Washington, describing instances all over the South. There are 30,000 pages of material related to these complaints in the National Archives today. And as these thousands and thousands of complaints poured in as the years went by, the policy of the federal government was that there was no statute on which a U.S. attorney could bring a case against a person for holding slaves except in very narrow circumstances. And so the policy of the federal government was that it would not involve itself in investigations or prosecutions of individuals who were still holding slaves in the South. And that was the policy of the federal government all the way until December the 11th, 1941.
Let's talk about that as the final question, because I think this is really stunning. Just the bald-faced cynicism involved in what finally brought an end to this officially or semi-officially sanctioned slavery.
It is cynical. And what finally brought things to an end was that on December the 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And in as President Roosevelt, the next President Roosevelt, is engaging the government to mobilize for a massive war, he gathers his cabinet and asks them all to give a report on the critical issues that face the war mobilization effort. And one topic that comes up is propaganda. And what are the propaganda vulnerabilities of the United States? And someone in the room, there's no record of who, but someone in the room says that the United States is going to have trouble over its treatment of African Americans in the South, and that the Japanese would argue in their propaganda, which was the case eventually, that America was not the country fighting for freedom, and that the proof of that was in its treatment of blacks in the South. And so Roosevelt immediately orders that an anti-lynching law be drafted and introduced in the Congress. It was still many years before such a law actually passed the Congress. But subsequent to this meeting, the Attorney General at the time, Francis Biddle, went back to his own office, asked the same questions of his immediate deputies, and one of his deputies says, yes, lynching is a big issue, but it's also a problem. You're going to find it hard to believe this, Mr. Attorney General, but there are places in the South where slaves are still being held, and it has been the policy of our department not to prosecute cases against those people. And the Attorney General is shocked initially, but then asks for a memo on how to prosecute such cases under laws which did exist. And 4 days later, on December the 11th, he distributes a memo to all U.S. attorneys, essentially saying that this has come to his attention and instructing them that from that day forward, they should prosecute cases, and giving them a sort of a cheat sheet on how to attempt to do that. And in 1942, just a few months later, a family in near Corpus Christi, Texas, a man and his adult daughter are arrested and charged under the new policy of prosecuting these cases, and they're tried later in 1942 and convicted, and in 1943 they're sentenced to prison for having held a man named Alfred Irving as a slave for more than 5 years. And I mark that as the technical end of the age of neo-slavery.
Mm-hmm. And of course it's gone on to the current situation where lynch mobs have been replaced by police murder. Douglas, I want to thank you very much for writing this book, for joining us today. The book is Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II by Douglas Blackman, published by Doubleday. And also the website is very, very interesting. It's www.slaverybyanothername.com. And you can get a lot of images, research materials, interviews, teaching aids, and whatnot. An incredible book, a must read, must pick it up. Douglas, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Okay, bye now. You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're doing a special for Black History Month this week, and this last half hour has been really stunning as far as I'm concerned. But the next half hour promises to be just as stunning and provocative. We're going to be listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on some more of the history of black people in America and what's behind it. So stay tuned. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
Amazing disgrace. When they brought us to this godforsaken place, they raped our mothers, incarcerated our fathers, and stole all the land. But in spite of all that, everything will be okay. And that's a natural fact. But nobody will never, they will never be free until they free me and we, me and we. Oh, 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 oh.
Welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show, and that was the World Saxophone Quartet with Amazing Disgrace from their CD Political Blues. That seems to be a very fitting song for this show. As I mentioned before the break, this next segment is an excerpt from a speech given by Bob Avakian a number of years ago. The speech is titled Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And this excerpt is, they're selling postcards of the hanging. The entire speech is available for listening and downloading at www.revolutiontalk.net. In this excerpt, Avakian drives home the point that all the terrible oppression of black people that we've been talking about is not a thing of the past. No matter how much they try to convince us that we're now a colorblind society and we're past all that, or, what I think is even worse, that black people bring on their own oppression, it continues today. A little different in form, but just as savage in content. And in the end, Avakian challenges us with a critical question. What kind of society is this?
Back in the day, Bob Dylan began one of his epic songs, Desolation Row, this way. They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. I don't know what that second line, they're painting the passports brown, is all about. Someone suggested maybe it's the Nazis and Hitler, because brown was a color associated with them. But what I want to focus on here has to do with the first line. They're selling postcards of the hanging. In the ugly history of this country and all its horrors, selling postcards of the hanging, in particular, selling postcards of the lynchings of black men, was literally a pastime, a kind of social activity in which all too many white people took part for 100 years and more, even after slavery was ended. Take the case of Claude Neal, who was accused of raping and killing a white woman and was lynched in Florida in 1934. Not only did a lynch mob hang him, they mutilated his body in the most horrible and vile way, and parts of his body were taken as souvenirs. And that's not all of it or the worst of it. His lynching was announced in advance, and people came as if it were a picnic. It was even announced in the Associated Press News Service and went out around the country. Thousands of people, including many solid citizens, came in this picnic atmosphere. One interesting thing is people on their way to an American Legion convention stopped off to witness the lynching. And some people were angry that they got there too late. You remember the American Legion? That's an organization of veterans formed after World War I who supported every reactionary, aggressive war of plunder and conquest carried out by the American government, including the latest war on Iraq. Photographers lined up to take pictures of Claude Neal's body, knowing that if they got just the right angle, they could make a lot of money selling the picture. And yes, from photographs of his mutilated body hanging from a tree, postcards were made and sold. Or look at what happened to Mary Turner and her husband Haynes Turner in Georgia in 1918. Their boss, a white man named Hampton Smith, was killed. Smith's wife actually accused another black man of this killing. But when a white mob couldn't find him, they took several other black men and lynched them instead, including Haynes Turner. Mary Turner dared to protest and condemn this publicly. She called for the people who did this to be punished. And what was done to her as a result of that? She was taken by a mob, stripped, hung upside down, and burned to death. And that's still not the worst of it. Mary Turner was 8 months pregnant. And while she was hanging and burning, someone stepped up, cut open her abdomen, and the baby fell out. It uttered a cry, and it was stomped to death. This is the history of this country. This is a small part of the history of this country. Then there's a story of Emmett Till. Emmett Till was born and grew up in Chicago. In 1955, when he had just turned 14, he went to Mississippi to visit family there. His mother warned and she schooled him about what he would find in Mississippi, what a young black male like himself should expect, what he must do and not do in order to stay alive. And think about the fact that a mother has to school her child that way just when he goes to visit family. But Emmett Till was full of life and full of fun. One day, while in Money, Mississippi, he made the fatal mistake of whistling at a white woman as he was leaving a store owned by her husband. A few days later, the store owner and his brother-in-law came in the middle of the night with guns and took Emmett Till away. They were seen beating him as they drove him away. His relatives began looking for his body along riverbanks and under bridges, where black folks always look when things like this happen, as his uncle put it. Think about that. Think about what it means, where black folks always look when this kind of thing happens. Think about what that tells you about this country. Emmett Till's body was found in a river. He was beaten and shot to death, beaten so badly he could barely be recognized, even by his mother. A 14-year-old boy, lynched, for what? For whistling at a white woman. In an act of tremendous courage and large-mindedness, his mother, Mamie Till, displayed his body publicly in Chicago, and she refused to have it touched up so that all could see what had been done to him. His body was viewed by tens of thousands of black people in Chicago. The story of what happened to Emmett Till aroused deep anger among black people all over the country. It shocked many white people in many parts of the country, and it became an international news story and outrage. But back in Mississippi, white people rallied to the defense of the men who had kidnapped and brutally murdered Emmett Till. These men were put on trial only because of the outrage around the country and around the world. Death threats and terror against black people in the area where this lynching took place was increased to keep them from saying what they knew and how they felt about this lynching. In a courtroom that was segregated, with white people filling the seats and the few black people who were allowed in forced to stand in the back, the jury of all white men found the murderers of Emmett Till not guilty in an hour. Their lawyers even accused Mamie Till and the NAACP of conspiring to cook up this whole story of a lynching. Actually, Emmett Till was alive in Detroit, these lawyers claimed. Not long after they were acquitted of this crime, the two men sold their story to a national magazine, telling in detail how they brutally murdered Emmett Till. But nothing was ever done to them. Despite a massive campaign calling for the federal government to indict these two men, the government refused. Sound familiar? Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was president of the United States at the time, never even answered a telegram sent to him by Mamie Till. J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, called this brutal lynching of Emmett Till an alleged murder. And he gave much more attention to investigating the involvement of communists in protesting this lynching than he ever did to the lynching itself. But the lynching of Emmett Till became a rallying cry for black people. People stood up who had never stood up before, as Mamie Till put it.
A quick reminder, this is the Michael Slate Show, and you're listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
In talking about these lynchings, I'm not exaggerating any of this. In fact, I have actually left out some of the most gruesome and disgusting details in talking about these lynchings, because there is only so much of this that you can stand to talk about or to hear about. And these were not the so-called isolated incidents, the way they always try to tell us whenever they get caught in one of their brutalities and murders. the way they try to cover up the real crimes of this system and those who rule it. Thousands of black people were lynched in those times, and all black people lived with a constant terror of this. Listen to the following statement by the author of a book about lynching. He said, "It is doubtful that any black male growing up in the rural South in the period 1900 to 1940 was not traumatized by a fear of being lynched." What is he saying with this? Nothing less than this. No black male growing up in the rural South in that period could be free of that fear. Every black male was haunted and scarred deeply by that fear. Think about what that means, and think about how this touched black people as a whole. A sociologist who studied black life in Mississippi in the 1930s learned how deeply the threat of lynching was in the minds of all black people, from the very young to the very old. And in a PBS program on the system of segregation in the South, which was called the Jim Crow system, they quoted a psychologist who said that every black person living in the South under Jim Crow was living actually under a death sentence. It might or might not actually get carried out, but it was always there. Black people could be killed for anything they did which might offend some white people. And the whites who killed them would never be punished. A black man could be lynched for looking at a white woman in a way that some white people thought was the wrong way. And the whites who killed him, again, would never be punished. Or a grown black man could be killed for not calling a young white boy, sir, or for not stepping off the sidewalk to make way for white people, or for any reason, or no reason at all. And this was related to the overall outrages to which black people were subjected. This experience of lynching and its effect on the masses of black people can, in a real sense, be taken as representing and concentrating the experience of black people as a whole, long after literal slavery, with all its horrors, had been ended in the 1860s. Frederick Douglass was a slave himself, who, after he got his own freedom, spent his life fighting against the oppression of black people and other injustices. Invited to speak at a July 4th celebration, Douglass made clear that July 4th was nothing to celebrate and that America was guilty of great crimes. Here's what he said about it. "What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants are brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgiving, with all your parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour." And Douglass also said, "America may accuse others of savagery, but really it has no equal when it comes to this." He said, "For revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival." As the saying goes, truer words were never spoken. Douglass spoke these words while slavery still legally existed in the United States, but his comments apply just as much even after outright slavery was ended. And all this time, while all these lynchings and other acts of incredible cruelty were being carried out, with all the oppression they embodied and enforced, All this time, those who rule this country, those who refuse to do anything to stop these lynchings and other acts of terror and atrocities, those who were responsible for these and other barbaric crimes, all this time, they never stopped proclaiming, "This is the greatest country in the world. This is the greatest country that has ever been. This is the leader of the free world. This is the homeland of freedom and democracy." It is not just that many white people acted like depraved beasts. And it is not that some were actually devils, although it certainly may have seemed that way many times in the history of this country. The deeper thing is that all these horrors were shaped by, they were encouraged by, and they served to keep in effect a whole system, a system that could not have existed without first slavery and then near slavery. And segregation and terror centered in the South while the great majority of black people lived there, chained in one way or another to the rural South and on white-owned plantations. White supremacy is built into the foundation of this country. It is something this system and those who rule it could not do without, even if they wanted to, which they don't.
A quick reminder, this is the Michael Slate Show, and you're listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
And this has continued down to the present. Despite all the false claims these days about how this is now a colorblind society, segregation and discrimination continue against black people and other people of color. Every time there is a study or a survey to determine this, it shows without fail that segregation and discrimination exist in housing, in jobs, in schools, in healthcare, in every part of society. And this continues to be backed up with brutality and violence. The last time I spoke publicly in this country in 1979, I took a detour from the speaking tour to go to Chester, South Carolina, because black people there were uprising because a young black male in the year 1979 had been lynched for dating a white girl. And more recently in, yes, Texas, there was a horror of what was done to James Byrd, a black man who was taken by white thugs and good old boys, tied to the back of a pickup and dragged until his head was separated from his body and his body was dismembered. So this is still going on in this greatest of all countries. But today it is mostly the police who openly, as the police, carry out brutality and terror against black youth and black people in general. Applying that author's statement on lynching to the present, we could put it this way. It is doubtful that there is a young black male growing up in the U.S. today, in the South or the North, who does not have a very real fear of being brutalized or even murdered by the police. And again, this touches all black people. Another book on the history of lynching of black people in the South makes this point, and think about this. Black parents learned to fear more for some sons than for others. Those who were surly, who had attitude, who were rebellious or were careless, who had not learned the art of appearing to know their place, they were in greater danger. And tragically, parents had no choice but to try to keep their sons especially from showing those qualities like self-confidence, curiosity, ambitiousness that could be interpreted as insolence or arrogance by white people. However, this author goes on to say, there was only so much that could be done by the parents in trying to prevent disaster. Any unlucky circumstance could instantly put a black man at deadly risk. And today we see the same thing. In our party's work in the housing projects, one of the most heartrending things we've learned is how black mothers in the projects start to worry early on if the boys that they've given birth to start to show that they might grow up to be large. Because then they'll have everything come down on them that comes down on a large black male. Think of what this means, that a mother from the time her child is 2 or 3 years old has to worry that he might grow up to be too big, so he might be seen to be a threat by the police and then cut down and murdered brutally by them. What kind of a society? What kind of a system is this?
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and that was an excerpt from a speech entitled Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. Now, this entire speech, if you like this and you want to hear the entire speech, it's available for listening to or downloading at www.revolutiontalk.net. What kind of system is this, and what are we going to do about it? These are the critical questions that we try to bring to life every week on this show, because answering them is a big part of understanding that things don't have to be this way. This is not the natural order of things, no matter what they tell us. There's a whole better way we could be and should be living. The world cries out for radical and revolutionary change, but it all depends on us and what we do. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. I want to thank my guests today and all of you for tuning in. I also want to thank Henry Carson and Age for their production assistance. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. I really enjoy hearing from you. I look forward to it. And I learn a lot from the comments that people make. We're going to go out now with that song that you've been hearing in the background. You know, you can hear the creaking ship, the slave master's whiplash, the thunder and lightning. Well, I thought that this would be a very powerful way to end today's show. The song is Ship Ahoy from the OJs.
Just waiting to be saved. Oh.